Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, new revelations about the Trump presidency from someone on the inside. John Bolton famously refused to testify in front of congressional committees during the impeachment hearings. But the former National Security Advisor has shared his view of the president in a new book. A big takeaway: there's no question Trump was holding up aid to Ukraine in exchange for dirt on the Bidens. Or at least that's what those who've gotten their hands on the book say. As we recorded this episode, the Trump administration was fighting the book's release. Peter Baker of the New York Times is one of those people who's already read it. He joined me to discuss how, if at all, these revelations might affect Donald Trump and the 2020 election. Peter, you write that when it comes to President Trump and his administration, what was once shocking seems like just another day, and now we have John Bolton's book. What is this? Is this a new normal?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, on some levels, what you see in John Bolton's book ratifies things we've been hearing and seeing with our own eyes and, of course, reporting on now for 3 years. It's a president who doesn't seem particularly well informed about the world, a White House that's dysfunctional and rife with internal division, you know, decision-making that's impulsive and, you know, instinct driven rather than, you know, deliberate. But I think it's really striking to see it all put in one place by somebody who's in the Oval Office every day. You know, the accounts we've had so far have been journalistic or have been by lower level aides, perhaps, or the anonymous book, of course. John Bolton was the president's national security advisor for 17 months. I can't think of any book, Diane, you and I have been around for a while in Washington. There are a lot of tell-all books over the years, and some of them have been very unflattering about the presidents that they wrote about. But I can't think of any that is quite as damning as this one. This one has a national security advisor saying the president of the United States was only about himself and cared about his own fortunes, even at the expense of national interests, and that he did so many things that he used the phrase obstruction of justice as a way of life. That's a really powerful statement. And I guess what the point of the story was, let's not look aside simply because we feel like we've seen a lot of this before. Some of this is actually really important to look at.
So John Bolton was somebody who was there on a daily basis. I think we should not put aside the fact that he was asked to testify during the Trump impeachment hearings and chose not to when the House asked him to, said he would wait for a subpoena from the Senate, which never came, but instead comes a $2 million advance for his book, which does not make him look great.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And he's getting a lot of grief from both sides at this point, right? He's getting grief from the Trump critics who say, hey, how come you didn't come forward? Even if you didn't have a subpoena, nothing stopped you from giving an interview or giving a speech or just telling the nation what you knew, even if the Senate didn't want to hear it. And of course, he's getting a lot of grief from the Trump right, which is portraying him as a traitor. That was the word that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo used just last night. So yeah, he's getting it a lot from both sides. And it's reasonable to ask about his role in this and his motivations and all of that. What I try not to lose sight of is, what are we hearing from him, though? What are we learning about the president from him? One of the things you can say about John Bolton, he's a real hardliner. He's a very strong hawk. A lot of people don't like his views. Even a lot of Republicans found him hard to work with in the Bush administrations or so forth. But in my experience with him anyway, almost 20 years now knowing him, I've known him to tell us what he thought and what he saw in a straightforward, forthright way. And I think, therefore, again, you may find the messenger flawed if you don't particularly like his politics or you don't particularly like his handling of this particular thing. But what is he telling us? And is that something that's credible? And I think that's what I'm focused on.
How much of the book have you had an opportunity to read? Nearly 500-page book.
Yeah, it's a long book, but it's got a lot in it. I've read almost all of it. I got a couple chapters to go. Basically, I power read through everything basically to try to make sure I didn't miss anything important. I'm sure there's some things I have. still to learn. And it's, you know, every couple pages or something, there's something you didn't know, or at least a characterization that's really fascinating, an inside detail or insight in something we thought we knew.
So give me some of the most stunning details that you found in the book.
Right. Well, there's the issues of what the president knows or doesn't know, right? He didn't seem to know that Britain was a nuclear power. He asked, hey, is Finland part of Russia? He seems, the phrase that John Bolton used is stunningly uninformed. And in fact, he constantly would say things in meetings, according to Bolton, that were just flatly not true. And Bolton wouldn't have any idea where he would get this supposed information from. So throughout the book, you see laced phrases in parentheses like, totally not true, or no idea where that came from, or phrases like that that are meant to convey to you that Bolton and his other aides were scratching their heads trying to say, where is this supposed information coming from? Imagine a lot of presidents, there's a lot of information out there to be had, and you're not going to know all of it as a president. But this one, according to Bolton, and we've heard from other aides too, seems not to know even a lot of the basics.
I was interested in the Trump defense of the Saudis in the murder of Khashoggi that came out of Ivanka's emails. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, we often wonder, is President Trump saying something or doing something flamboyant or incendiary or outrageous in order to distract us from some other story? And in this case, it does seem like he was. So he comes out basically, you know, defending Saudi Arabia in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who worked for the Washington Post. And he says to John Bolton, hey, this will take the heat off of Ivanka, because there were stories at the time about her using her private email account for government business. Does that sound familiar? Yes, it does. Of course, President Trump milked that issue with Hillary Clinton to great effect in 2016. So the idea that his own daughter, who is a senior advisor on the White House staff, would be basically doing something similar was a pretty damning story. So he tried to take the heat off of her by wading into the Khashoggi case. And again, what we often see with President Trump is he's taking attention away from one damaging story by creating another one. So it's not always it's clear that that is the best strategy, but it is interesting to see how that documented by John Bolton.
And what about the issue of asking the Chinese leader for assistance with his own reelection?
Right.
How long ago might that have happened? Do we have any idea from Bolton's book? Does he document when that conversation would have taken place?
He does, yes. And if I'm remembering correctly, it was last year, 2019. So in other words, with the coming into this election year, and they're having a meeting, I believe this is the Osaka meeting and at the sidelines of the G20. I would want to go back and double check. And what he says to him is, you need to, as part of this trade discussion, you need to buy a lot of farm goods. So that makes me popular in the farm states and it will help me re-election. And John Bolton says he's pleading with Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, to help re-elect him. And, you know, look, foreign policy is always connected to domestic politics, or often anyway, and particularly farm sales. I mean, when Reagan lifted the embargo against the Soviet Union in the 1980s, you know, he did it with the idea in mind that American farmers were an important constituency. What you don't see happen, at least as often anyway in the histories that we've read, is to a president to directly ask a foreign leader, help me win re-election. And in fact, you know, the line was taken out of his book, according to Vanity Fair. The line he actually used was, make me win. Now, apparently, that's according to Vanity Fair, which says it saw unredacted versions of the book before the White House took that out. So that's not in the pop copy you would see if you buy it next Tuesday. Assuming that's true, it just gives across what a open, overt, unvarnished appeal this was by the President of the United States asking a foreign leader to intervene. Once again, we've seen this before, to intervene in our elections.
Is there clarifying information in the book about conversations between Trump and Russian President Putin about the same issue, helping him to get reelected?
Yeah, there's not a lot of insight about the private conversations, partly because Bolton wasn't included in the room at times. Some of these conversations that President Trump has had with President Putin were only with the translators. And Bolton, even though he's the national security advisor, is on the outside of the door trying to get information later from the translator, interviewing, in effect, the translator, like we as reporters would, trying to say what was said in there, who said what. Basically, Bolton's view of that is that Putin had Trump wrapped around his finger, and that the last thing they wanted to do was leave Trump alone in the room with Putin, because they felt like Putin would be manipulating him in some fashion or another. So they didn't understand the relationship. John Bolton says he never directly asked the president, why do you like Putin so much? He doesn't offer a theory of the case in the book, but he did find Putin to have an unusual hold over the president in terms of being able to shape his thinking.
Do you have any thoughts about what that hold might be?
It's a great question. One thing that's a consistent theme in John Bolton's book and other reporting and accounts we've seen over the years is the president's admiration or fascination or perhaps a little envy of strongmen leaders, right? The Erdogans, the Xi Jinpings, the Putins, the Dutertes, these guys who exercise power in what the president seems to perceive as a tough, strong way, without being bothered with the annoyances of a bureaucracy or a congressional system or democracy. And it seems that Putin is the exemplar of this, the one who in Trump's mind is a model of strong, decisive leadership as he sees himself being. Never mind again that Russia is a different system than ours. That seems to be one theory anyway. And there's a whole, we've been through this for years over what kind of business the president had or might want to have in Russia, whether there might be some connection there. Obviously, that's all been investigated and there isn't been any definitive evidence to the contrary when the president says there's no collusion. But it's, I think, an enduring question about this presidency that will persist long after it's over.
What does he say about Venezuela in the book?
I'll be honest with you, this is one chapter I haven't read yet, so I don't know much about it. It is a strong interest of John Bolton's. That's something where he played a key role in trying to ramp up pressure on Venezuela to keep the president focused on it. Remember, this is a president who has been leery of internationalism, leery of asserting American influence or power on other countries if it didn't have anything to do with us. He says we don't want to be the policeman of the world. One place that John Bolton helped convince him to be a policeman to some extent was Venezuela, to try to pull down Maduro, the autocrat who runs Venezuela. And there is a quote in the book in which John Bolton says the president, he quotes John Kelly saying the president once said it would be cool to invade Venezuela. Now, I don't know anybody who thinks that would be cool. It would be difficult and arduous and deadly probably, but it suggests, I think, a mindset where some of these issues that should be treated with great gravity and seriousness are handled in a somewhat flippant way.
What about Trump's attitude toward reporters, according to Bolton?
Not a fan, yes. He says, of course, in public that reporters are the enemies of the people. Well, one reason people object to that phrase is because it harkens back to Stalin, who then took that kind of a justification to its absolute murderous logical conclusion. Well, in this book, John Bolton quotes him, President Trump once saying about journalists that they should be executed and that they're all scumbags. And he actually even tells his White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, to tell the attorney general to arrest some journalists who had written a story that he didn't like, that he leaked some, had some leak in it he didn't like, not classified information, just a story about a meeting, and arrest them, put them in jail for a few days, and that'll make them tell us their sources. So now that didn't happen. Obviously, we haven't had any executions, thank goodness, or arrests, but I think it tells you something about the mindset and the mentality. And I think that, only because he's had people around him who wouldn't do those things have we been spared of a tougher crackdown on journalism. But the idea that a president, even if he wasn't being serious, would say that journalists ought to be executed, I think is a pretty troubling thing.
Peter, to what extent was this book actually vetted by the people who were supposed to be vetting it?
So the White House National Security Council has spent more time reviewing this book than John Bolton did writing it, okay? So John Bolton resigned last September. The president said he fired him. And he turned in the book by the end of December. That's just 3.5 months later. The White House has had it since the end of December. We're now in June. That's 5.5 months. Now, according to John Bolton's lawyer, he went through an extensive process with the career employee who does classification reviews. And the point is not that the White House is allowed to take out things that are embarrassing to the president or things he wouldn't like to have out there. It's supposed to only be a scrutiny for things that are classified, things that would be dangerous to the country if they got out. And this employee went back and forth with John Bolton repeatedly. Here are some things I think that need to be taken out or reworded or what have you. And Bolton would send back his changes that would satisfy this woman who was monitoring that process. And then they finished the process. So you'd gone through and had no more requests for any changes. At that point, they assumed they would get the clearance to publish. Well, what happens? Robert O'Brien, who was Bolton's successor as National Security Advisor, a political appointee, now jumps into the process and tells one of his political appointees to restart the process all over again, to re-review it all over again, even though a career person has already said, no, there's nothing in here that's classified or dangerous. Now, that smacks of politics rather than, you know, a genuine concern about classification. They have supposedly told the court, here are six examples of things that are classified that shouldn't be allowed out from the book, but that's not public. We don't know what those six things are. All we know is that the president has said he thinks everything he has said should be highly classified. So if they're going by that standard, I don't know. That would be setting a whole new precedent. I don't know whether a court would agree with that.
So that is to be argued today at 1 o'clock in the U.S. District Court. What's your thinking about that?
Well, it feels like the horse is well out of the barn here at this point. You know, the book not only is in the hands of journalists now all over town, it's been distributed across the country and even across the world because the publication date is Tuesday. Bookstores don't get a book the day before they put it on the shelves. They have it well in advance. So they're trying to go after this book long after they have any logistical and feasible way of stopping it. And that suggests to a lot of people that they're not really serious about it, that they know this is kind of a loser. I talked to four different former White House lawyers, Republican and Democrat, and I said, well, can you remember a White House ever doing anything like this? No, they couldn't remember. So the theory is that the Justice Department is acting because the president is really mad about this and wants to see action. So they've taken action. But as a legal matter, it seems like an uphill battle.
Tell me about the president's choice. Initial choice of Juneteenth as a day for a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and whether his aides at any time said to him early on, Mr. President, that's not such a good day for you to be in Tulsa.
It clearly did not get through anyway if they did. I don't think he knew what Juneteenth was. In fact, I think a lot of his staff who picked that date didn't know what Juneteenth was. And only after they had picked it, but before they announced it, apparently, as I understand the timeline, they had picked it but hadn't yet announced it. Then they learned it was Juneteenth, but they went ahead with the announcement anyway. Didn't think it would be such a big to-do, obviously. They had misjudged, especially in the environment. It might not have been a big deal if it was a year ago. It might not have been a big deal if it hadn't been for George Floyd. But to announce that in the throes of this very big national conversation we're having about race in this country just seemed to be like sending a message. Whether they meant it or not, it came across like they were sending a message. And I think it was probably more lack of thought than it was an intentional dog whistle. But a lot of people saw it as a dog whistle, and you saw a very rare quick retreat on the part of the president after Republicans like Jim Langford, the senator, said, wait, maybe this meant not a good idea.
I would be concerned about demonstrations there in Tulsa. Certainly today marks a major turning point in this country for Black Americans. And even to hold the rally there in Tulsa tomorrow doesn't seem like such a good idea.
The fact that he picked Juneteenth and Tulsa, which was the site of this horrific massacre of Blacks 99 years ago, just felt like it couldn't be a coincidence. It probably was just uninformed, right? We've seen from Bolton's book, this is not an informed person about history. But whether or not it was, that the two things together certainly made it very inflammatory as an idea. And that doesn't change just because it's tomorrow. Look, one thing that's good is now I think people now have a much greater knowledge about what Juneteenth is, at least.
And of course, Trump is taking credit for that.
Exactly right. See, I've made it a great holiday. It's a really interesting moment in the conversation where we're trying to grapple with these big issues. And Juneteenth reminds us of our legacy in this country and the history that we have yet to overcome fully. Here we are 155 years, I guess, right, this year after Juneteenth, which was the reading of the Emancipation Proclamation in Texas. And we have yet to really purge our country of the vitriol and the hatred and the sense of the vision that was left over from that time.
I just hope to heaven that there are not huge outbreaks of violence in that area as a result of his going there.
Well, I certainly hope not. It's going to be a big rally. They're telling us 19,000 people indoors, another 19,000 people out of doors. It's a state he won by, I think, 30-some points 4 years ago. So it's not a battleground state. But he chose a state that was, safer from the coronavirus in the sense that I think that they were further along in the reopening. And secondly, one that he would get a lot of support. And he's looking for support. He hasn't been at a rally now for 3 months or so. I think he's feeling itchy, anxious about that. And he wanted a strong demonstration of his supporters to kind of restart this campaign at a moment when he's way behind the polls. So he bought a lot more controversy than he needed to, but he doesn't seem to worry about that. That doesn't seem to bother him too much.
More of my conversation with Peter Baker after a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Peter Baker, Chief White House Correspondent for The New York Times. Going back for a moment to the book, President Trump calls it pure fiction and at the same time says it contains classified information. So how can they have it both ways? How can they legitimately go to court and say, hear the president say it's pure fiction. On the other hand, it contains classified information.
Yeah, it would be the first time fiction was ever classified. It's hard to see. It's not consistent. Diane, this should not surprise us. This is the Trump administration. It's not consistent. And so, look, he's going to say it's fake no matter what. That's just what he does. There's not, he's never admitted to anything, true or not. And again, my experience in dealing with John Bolton over the years is you might not agree with him. You might think he's being self-serving or you don't like his politics, but he generally tells you what he thinks and what he saw from his point of view. And I think that, if I had to judge the two accounts, I think you'd give him some credibility there.
What about the non-disclosure agreement that Trump says Bolton signed?
Well, that's part of this pre-publication review thing. In other words, as somebody who served in a position with access to classified information, you're obligated to let the government look at your book before you publish it in order to make sure you're not giving away secrets you were given access to while in government. It's not supposed to be that you don't say things that are embarrassing about the president. That's just not it. Nobody thinks that's an enforceable proposition.
So if the court were to rule in Trump's favor, I mean, that would hamstring an awful lot of people from publishing what they saw or what they regard as information the public should have a right to know.
Yeah, I'm, of course, as you and I, as journalists, are big fans of memoirs. I think that people have a certain duty to history tell us what they saw, what they experienced. They're exercising power in our name as taxpayers. And, it's not some secret chamber. It's supposed to be a public, democratic, transparent government to the best possible extent. Now, having read most of the book, almost all of the book, I haven't seen anything in there that looks obviously classified to me. There's no reference that I've seen to code word programs or secret surveillance or some sort of espionage sources or spies or something that would endanger security. All I see are conversations between the president and his staff or conversations between the president and foreign leaders that he might not want to have out there. I get that. No president would. Every president finds books like this to be, vexatious. But that's a different thing than saying a national secret. And the question then becomes, can a president's conversation with foreign leaders automatically be considered to be classified no matter what? And if so, for how long? That's something the judge may get into. We'll see. I don't see how the judge, by the way, can do it in a way that will actually prevent the book from coming out. I think it's, you know, prior restraint just doesn't work. It hasn't worked generally in this country. It may be that they could penalize Bolton on the back end. They may try to take his money away. That kind of thing might be possible, but I don't see how they can stop the book.
What's your guess about how the court is going to rule?
Royce Lamberth is the judge in this case, not, I think, he's a tough-minded guy with a lot of independence, been on the court for a long time. He's not going to simply roll over for the administration. But I would be surprised if the court tried to stop publication at this point. Remember, the biggest case one of the biggest cases the New York Times ever had as a newspaper was about this issue of prior restraint. It was the Pentagon Papers that showed the court said, no, you cannot stop publication in advance, even if you don't like it. Now, he's not a newspaper. John Bolton's not a newspaper. He's not a journalist in that sense. He's somebody who had been in the government. So the rules are different. What they are alleging here is breach of contract, trying to get around the First Amendment issue. But I still think it seems like an uphill battle for the government.
I want to take you to some other events that have happened this week. Two sharp rebukes of the Trump administration, one on the Dreamers and the other for LGBT workers. Talk about what's happened here and what it could mean. Some people have argued that, especially in regard to the Dreamers, that it was a sloppy case put forward by the administration, purposely sloppily. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, so on the DACA case, the case of these younger immigrants who came to the country when they were kids brought by their parents, and President Obama had a program to spare them from deportation, in effect. President Trump tried to overturn that. And what you saw in the ruling this week, written by Chief Justice Roberts and then joined by the four liberals on the court, in effect was saying you just didn't do it right. You know, you have to have due process. You have to go through the procedures in order to make the kind of change you're talking about, and you didn't do it. So they didn't say you can't ever do it. They didn't say a president can't have some, you know, authority here, since it was a president's authority that started the program in the first place. They're saying you guys were basically incompetent in the way you managed it, which, by the way, is a thing that John Bolton talks about too. He says in an interview that will be aired on Sunday with Martha Raddatz on ABC that one reason he doesn't support President Trump for re-election is because he's not competent. And it does seem rather extraordinary if you're going to take something as big as this DACA program and try to unravel it, that you wouldn't do it, you know, the proper way. Now, the president says today in his tweet, well, they didn't actually rule against me. They simply asked us to resubmit it as if it wasn't a big deal. It's a big deal. And what the court is saying is you cannot simply run roughshod over the rules because you don't like something. You have to do it the right way. Would this president do it again if he wins re-election and has enough time to restart this whole process? Maybe. It also may start a legislative conversation again about a way to kind of rewrite the law to fix this. Most people, even Republicans, were actually relieved by the court's decision because they don't want to have to deal with this in the fall election too. They just assume these DACA people will be allowed to stay. Most Republicans, not all, but most Republicans in the Senate would just assume they'll be allowed to stay. And then they can deal with immigration issues other than this one.
So you wouldn't buy the argument that it was put forward intentionally, sloppily?
I don't know enough to say that. I do know that Chief Justice Roberts has shown disdain for the lawyering of this administration before. He, in the case of the census, you remember they wanted to put a question in the census about citizenship, and that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was Chief Justice Roberts who said, no, you can't. Not because you don't have the power to do it, because you just didn't do it right. And you gave me a obviously fake reason for why you wanted to do it, and I'm not buying it. So he, I think, now twice has said to this administration, and it may be other examples, you know, if you're going to do stuff, you have to do it right, and don't insult our intelligence by, you know, this slipshod way of handling. That's his message anyway.
The LGBT workers case was even more dramatic in the makeup of the decision.
Absolutely, yes. It was written by Neil Gorsuch, who was President Trump's first appointee to the court. And along with Chief Justice Roberts and then the four liberals, that meant for a 6-3 majority. And I think that really upset a lot of conservatives about Gorsuch. They thought he was one of them. They have for years fretted about justices appointed by Republicans who they thought were conservative, but then drift to the left over the years, like Harry Blackmun and David Souter and Anthony Kennedy and so forth. And the last thing they wanted was yet another one. They thought Gorsuch wouldn't be that kind of a justice. And it turns out, at least on this one case, he ruled against them. So that's going to make it complicated for the president, because one of the things he's campaigned on was being the person who put these two great conservatives on the court, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. So you need to reelect me so I can put more great conservatives on the court. Now it's a little more complicated because one of the biggest cases and one that will frustrate the right is authored by one of his own appointees. So what is he going to say on the campaign trail about that? We need more Gorsuches? Now he really can't say that.
What he said was in a tweet, I'm paraphrasing, do you get the impression the Supreme Court doesn't like me? Everything is all about him.
Everything is all about him. Everything is about him. But I think, by the way, I do have that impression.
You do have that impression.
They don't like him. I don't think this is a week where they showed that they liked him very much. But of course, the justices are not ruling based on whether they like a president or not. They're judging based on their view or interpretation of the law and the Constitution. Obviously, you know, politics is a part of the court system just like it is everything else. But, you know, he does see everything through the prism of himself. Everything is about himself. And the idea that a justice would make a ruling on a law based on his interpretation or her interpretation of what the law says, that's not the first thing that comes to his mind.
So as you write, President Trump faces a 137-day sprint to Election Day, but at the moment, he seems to be alienating all but his hardcore supporters. So where does that leave him?
Yeah, it's really interesting. He is the first president, Diane, who has never had the support of a majority of Americans in the major polls for a single day of his presidency. He has always been about his base. He has always been about keeping the people who got him there in the first place and finding some way to win re-election with the same strategy in effect that won in 2016. Now, he won with kind of an inside straight in 2016. He lost the popular vote, but happened to win the right number of states to win the electoral vote. So that was always kind of a dicey thing to try to replicate. That doesn't happen very easily. Trying to replicate that was kind of an odd, you know, kind of a tough strategy anyway, because he's never reached out beyond his base. He's never tried to build a larger coalition of support for himself, never reached out to independents in a big way, certainly never reached out to even conservative Democrats. And so he's banking on the idea he can do this all over again, win the right number of states, regardless of what the popular vote is. This time around, though, I mean, his numbers at this moment are so bad that it doesn't seem possible to do that. He's now 10 points down, more or less, behind Biden in most of the polls. That's much worse than with Hillary Clinton on Election Day 2016. Does that mean that's where he's going to be in November? No, the polls have been wrong. We'll see what happens. If the economy is in fact coming back to life, if the coronavirus really does begin to fade, that will affect our, you know, voting. But we don't know. And he's starting off from a very, very bad position as an incumbent president.
Oklahoma is seeing an increase in the number of COVID cases. And here he is about to hold an indoor rally for, as you said, 19,000 people in the face of this pandemic. If that, in fact, sets off another increase, how is that going to affect his campaign?
I mean, I think that would send a terrible message if that's what happens. If 14 days from now, we see a giant spike in Oklahoma of cases, he will be held, you know, he will be seen as responsible for that. Now, what he would say is, hey, what about those protests against George Floyd? There were tens of thousands of people in the streets and you guys didn't complain about that. Well, okay, if, you know, interesting point. the difference, two of the differences are, one, they were outdoors, which is a little safer. Two, when I was at those rallies and those protests, I saw most people wearing masks. They were really, ironically, for people that the president was calling anarchists, they were pretty much rule followers as far as the COVID thing was concerned. But this is an indoor rally. That's a different thing. They will be tested for temperature as they walk in, and they will be given masks, I think, if they want them, but they're not being required to. And the president has shown all along he doesn't believe in wearing masks. And I bet you that means everybody on stage with him will most likely not have masks on, because they often feel very uncomfortable wearing them because of him. And that's just testing, you know, this a lot further even than those street rallies did.
You know, there have been some questions, especially after his speech at the graduation ceremony.
West Point, yeah.
And whether he is actually physically ill.
Yeah.
Have you seen any indication that makes you think that way?
There were two things at the West Point event that were really interesting and troubling. One was the walk down the ramp. And he says, well, it was slippery and so forth. That one struck me as, okay, you know, it probably wasn't all that slippery. It didn't look all that steep, but he didn't want to fall. That doesn't necessarily seem all that surprising. The one that got me was the water class. And I was watching at the time, and I couldn't believe it. I never saw him do this before. We had to bring his other hand up, his right hand up, to help him get the water glass to his mouth. That seemed to indicate something more interesting or serious. I don't know what, I'm not a doctor, I don't want to pretend to be, but I hadn't seen that before with him. He's always had trouble walking. He's never been a great walker. You know, they try to make sure that they don't put him in a position where he has to walk very great lengths.
Really?
Public. Yes.
I mean, what do you mean trouble walking?
He can't walk long distances. It doesn't seem to be something he can do. And it may just be that he's just not very, you know, healthy. My father has gout. It may be that something like that where he has trouble. I don't know the answer to the question, but I do know that advanced people at the White House, when they're setting up a presidential event, traditionally with him, make sure there's very little walking to be done. For instance, when we went to France for the anniversary of Armistice Day, all the other leaders walked together down the Champs-Élysées and the president was brought by car. He doesn't do walking. So the walking on the ramp thing didn't surprise me because we've sort of seen that before. The cup thing I hadn't seen before, and that I don't know what the answer is. They haven't given us an answer, even though we've asked.
Do you have any doubt that he really wants to be reelected?
That's a great question. My colleagues, Maggie Haberman and Annie Carney, wrote a piece this week, got a lot of people's attention, asking that very question. And his own staff is in their private moments when they're not around him asking that question too, because he has acted in such a self-destructive way, because he acts, you know, he has not done what you would think would be needed to build an electoral coalition for the fall, because he hasn't talked at all about what he would do in the next 4 years. What would be his program for a second term? He hasn't told us, and he hasn't apparently even really discussed it in private. All of those reasons make a lot of, at least some of his advisors, wonder whether he really has his heart in it, whether he really wants another term. Now, he doesn't want to lose. He hates losing. There's nothing worse in his mind than a loser. So it's not that he is secretly hoping to lose necessarily, but that he's just not, you know, fully has his heart in the idea of a second term. And we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, incumbents who don't have their heart in it have a hard time winning.
Before we close, is there anything else you want to tell us?
Well, I think the thing that's important about Bolton's book is the portrait of a president who sees the office differently than his predecessors, right? In the, at least the post-Watergate era, presidents have at least tried to make distinctions between their own personal interests and those of the country. And it's not to say they weren't politically motivated. Of course they were. They all wanted to win re-election. But what John Bolton is saying here is he never saw a single action that wasn't driven by the president's personal election concerns. And this story with the China, you know, helped me win re-election, the story of his willingness to trade away criminal investigations to curry favor with dictators in Turkey and China, all speaks to this idea of somebody who sees, who doesn't see the lines that other presidents did. You know, he sees the presidency as his tool for the interest that he sees for himself. And that's what John Bolton's message is. Now, you might not agree with that. His own supporters, I'm sure, won't agree with that. They think, again, Bolton is just sour grapes and disgruntled employee, and they just might write it off. But it's an important, I think, argument to be had. And I think that his book has added a lot of information for us to think about.
Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks. Great talking to you as always.
That was Peter Baker, Chief White House Correspondent for the New York Times. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you want me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to be in touch. What are you finding most challenging? What questions do you have that need answers? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Be safe, stay well. I'm Diane Rehm.